I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Now, before you bite into your fast food, consider this. Butchering meat and processing chickens is dangerous, low-paying factory work. And a lot of it in this country is done by immigrant workers, sometimes illegally. So this is one area of the economy where immigration reform could have a huge impact. Reporter Anna Boyko-Wyrock sent us this story from Missouri.
In a small apartment in Knoll, Missouri, seven roommates from Somalia get ready for the night shift. Saida Chaama fries up meat and onion sambusas, a stuffed pastry. Next, she'll head across the river to a poultry processing plant run by Tyson Foods and work until early morning.
Are you going to good? American.
Chaama says America's been good to her. Tyson wages start at $9 an hour, no English required. But it's repetitive, dangerous work, and employee burnout is high. If she's injured or finds another opportunity, another immigrant worker would likely step in. Doris Meissner of Migration Policy Institute explains.
The poultry industry has been one of several industries that has had the clear experience that it needs foreign-born workers or access to foreign-born workers as part of its workforce.
Outside the Tyson plant, a sign reads, "Now hiring, call today." But it's immigrants and refugees, not locals, flocking to work here. At 4:30 p.m., night shift workers arrive at the plant. Some wear flowered skirts and others hijabs. The 1,500 or so employees come from Africa, the Pacific, Latin America. At some meat plants, workers are hired illegally, and there have been crackdowns. In 2001, Tyson was charged with smuggling in workers from Mexico. It was later acquitted. Now, the food industry is lobbying Washington to make it easier to hire immigrants, legally.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
That's Mike Brown,
today,
head of the National Chicken Council, recently testifying in Washington.
We seek workers who will stay on the job to become skilled and efficient, helping us.
Washington may grant millions of immigrants legal status. It may also let in more guest workers. And unlike before, let workers switch jobs instead of being tied to one employer. Doris Meissner calls that a breakthrough.
That is a very important new dynamic to put into the equation because that is what gives workers leverage.
How this might play out if immigrant workers get legal status, more rights, it's unclear. For now, many immigrants say they'll continue doing the tough work.
Lo baja, le da la vuelta.
In her living room, Irma Brown, from Guatemala, shows me how she trims chicken at the Tyson factory. Grab the carcass, flip it, hack off the wings, repeat. She does this for hours every day. She's proud of her work. She's bought a house, can support her kids. But it's worn down her wrists and arms. Brown's had three surgeries, but her hands still cramp up. Sometimes she can't sleep. She loses her grip on things, she says. She'll suddenly drop plates of food on the floor.
Now I'm packing like 60 to 70 in 1 minute.
That's Merlina Manuel from Micronesia. She talks about working in freezing temperatures, quickly packing chicken in foam trays.
If the order is really big and the time is really short, then they make it fast. Sometimes we really shout and say, "What's going on?" But we do what we have to do.
This work could intensify if regulators allow plants to speed up the processing line. Officials argue new rules could help contain bacteria. It would also save companies like Tyson money. Advocates worry that workers' injuries, already notorious, will increase. Tyson spokesman Gary Michelson says the company's policies prevent injuries.
We care about our employees. We value them. We want to make sure they're safe on the job. The right to a safe workplace is a part of our team member Bill of Rights.
Some immigrant workers want out. Karina Vega worked illegally at chicken plants for years after migrating from Mexico. Now she and other ex-poultry workers run a new Mexican restaurant across the street from the Tyson plant.
Toda mi vida que mi mano no sirva. Tengo cuatro niños.
Vega says she needs both hands to raise her kids.
Venimos a trabajar, pero si nos trataran un poquito mejor.
She says if the factories weren't so tough, maybe she would have stayed on. For now, though, Tyson and companies like it will count on someone else, perhaps another immigrant, to fill Vega's spot. For The World, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock in Knoll, Missouri.
Our final story today takes place here in Boston, where domestic workers and their employers are testing new ways to settle disputes outside of a courtroom. The World's Nina Porzucchi has a story.
are you?
Good to see
you. So nice to see you.
On a recent Saturday afternoon, a dozen women, nannies and house cleaners, many immigrants from Brazil, gather with employers in a living room in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They snack on cheese and crackers, breaking the ice a bit before talking about how to tackle some of the work troubles that can bubble up.
They said they would pay me for the gas and the mileage. They did that the first week, and I'm there almost 10 months now, and I haven't seen any more money about it. And I don't know what to do.
Anna Amaral from Brazil is a nanny in Boston. As she talks, several women in the room nod their head and offer advice.
They may not remember it as you do, Anna. They really may not. You have a conversation. I'm talking right now. You'll remember 30% of it, and it'll come out of your mouths in your own words. It's definitely an issue that could go to mediation.
That's Lydia Edwards, a lawyer at the Brazilian Immigrant Center here. She's fierce in the courtroom, but her goal here is to try to find ways to settle disputes between domestic workers and employers outside of the courtroom. The process seems simple. A worker brings a complaint to the center about, say, a wage issue. The center contacts the employer to see if they'd like to meet with trained mediators to find a solution instead of resorting to legal action. And the mediators know these conflicts well because they're domestic workers and employers themselves.
I wanted to figure out a way that workers could be a part of the resolution of their own issues.
Edwards started the project after the downtown Boston law firm where she'd worked downsized. Out of a job, she volunteered her legal expertise at the center, setting up a law office in the center's kitchen. She met with hundreds of Brazilians at that kitchen table, house cleaners and nannies. She realized laws about minimum wage and meal breaks don't always protect these workers.
Fighting over whether trick-or-treating time is payment time or not, which I've had to do in court, whether making a meal and eating some of it now negates you from getting paid for that. I've had those fights in court.
Edwards also realized that workers weren't always seeking a big settlement, rather something else.
Sometimes people are coming to me, and I notice as a lawyer, what you want, I couldn't give you anyway in court.
At the beginning, what I just was looking for, actually, was for an apology.
Again, nanny Anna Amaral. She first met Edwards at the Brazilian Center for help about unpaid wages, a common complaint for these workers. But it wasn't money that upset Amaral. Rather, how her employer treated her.
She lashed out at me in the library in front of other friends, other nannies, in front of the librarians.
Amaral did go to court in the end, and she won. But it still didn't feel resolved. These feelings are natural because of the intimacy of domestic work, says Edwards.
They took care of your children from birth sometime. They, like, really love and care for your parents. And vice versa. Like, you've had such an intense, intimate bond.
Edwards argues that in some cases, talking it out might help prevent a courtroom battle. Back in that Cambridge living room, the women hold a mock mediation between an employer, Peter, and Johnny, the caregiver for Peter's elderly father. Amaral practices mediating the case.
So whatever you share here, if you don't want us to share in front of Johnny, that is totally up to you. But we just would like to try to understand more what you're coming from when you say that is a lot on your shoulders right now. Is that okay?
So far, the center has successfully mediated 5 cases. A slow start, partly because people don't know that mediation is a legal tool. But Edwards hopes that'll change as word spreads.
No one should be working in the dark or feeling undervalued.
Meanwhile, other advocates for domestic workers are following this project's progress. In an industry that can lack protection, there's a search for other options. For the World, I'm Nina Porzucchi in Boston.
At the South Pole. Not as far south as that, you'll find mariachi, the quintessential music of Mexico, but not everyone loves it there. Many music educators, for example, don't take it all that seriously. It's considered bar music, unworthy of academic study. But it's becoming a different story just north of the border in Texas. The World's Jason Margolis has our story from San Antonio.
The story of mariachi music in Texas schools begins with Bel San Miguel Ortiz.
There's several names that they've given me, from godmother to the queen of the mariachis. I was the very first teacher of mariachi in anywhere in the world.
That's a tough thing to prove, though.
A lot of people will say, well, you're not the first. Yes, I am.
When Ortiz first started teaching music in Texas high schools, some people didn't like what she was doing.
We're talking about in the late 50s when discrimination was at its highest. And many of my colleagues reported me as saying that I was teaching choir, but everything was in Spanish.
Finally, in 1970, Ortiz got permission to teach a high school mariachi class. It's come a long way since then. When I met Ortiz, who is now 79, she was judging a regional competition for a statewide high school mariachi contest.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to begin with our final groups for today. Please welcome from Southwest ISD, Los Dragones.
Ten bands from South Texas participated in the competition. Each had about a dozen members. The boys wore ornate, embroidered suits, and the girls wore floor-length skirts, sashes, and jackets. The outfits were sewn with elaborate patterns and shiny buttons. The kids looked sharp. They played violins, trumpets, and guitars. Students also played the two key mariachi instruments, the guitarrón, essentially an enormous guitar, and the vihuela, a small guitar. There was also the occasional harpist and flute player. The students took turns walking to center stage and belting out solos. I kept forgetting that I was watching 15, 16, and 17-year-olds up on stage. They were great. High school junior Jonathan Rivera nailed a fantastic harp solo.
I went up there and we were playing. I was like, okay, calm down. You know, done this before. Vroom, vroom, vroom. Yeah, I got it. And then we started the song. I wasn't even close to the solo. We just started the song. And I was already like, boom, it hit me. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I got nervous. And after that, it just... Mariachi is more performing. You're actually like a Broadway show. You go and you sing and you act. When you go into mariachi, you can have the worst day of your life. You're like, your dog died, your parents are in the hospital, and your girlfriend left you, and you're like, oh, you got a performance today. Forgot about that. And you can't just go on stage with your face all frowning and whatnot. You gotta go up there and you gotta smile. You gotta do that.
Rivera also plays in a rock band, but like many of the students I met, he says he gravitated to mariachi because it connects him to his Mexican roots. Senior Celia Valles chose mariachi as an elective in the sixth grade.
And the primary reason was that the majority of my family doesn't speak English, so I felt it was really a way for me to connect to them.
Like other students I met, Valles' Spanish is not the best.
Spanish is actually my first language, but over the years, I haven't been able to use it as often. So it still comes, but it's not as naturally.
Has mariachi helped?
Yes, definitely.
Still, there are some who don't understand this embrace of mariachi. I heard tales of parents who were upset that their children were wasting their time on this cantina music. It's seen as kind of a joke by many, not worthy of musical study. Texas State University in San Marcos is trying to change that attitude. It's offering classes in mariachi methods and history. Undergraduates can earn a teaching certificate in mariachi music, and the school plans to offer a summertime master's program in mariachi in the near future. John Lopez is the coordinator of Latin music studies at Texas State. He says when mariachi was first introduced there in the 1990s, it was student taught.
Then I went to the School of Music and said, we need to take this class seriously like any other ensemble. You would never do this to orchestra. Orchestra would never be student-run with a faculty advisor.
He says putting mariachi in the classroom isn't just culturally important for Latino students. It's important musically. He says it's a challenging genre.
All of their ensembles are either instrumental or they're either vocal. But a mariachi is unique in the fact that every single person does sing and every single person does play, and they're woven almost all the time.
Mariachis face another challenge. They have to memorize their music. That's the way mariachis have always done it. The guys at the Mexican restaurants don't get to have sheet music.
They know a lot of songs. they need to be prepared at any time to play a song that somebody requests.
That can be anything from Elvis to Lady Gaga to pretty much everything in between. There was none of that, though, at the Texas High School competition, just traditional Mexican folk music. And that made Bel Ortiz, the godmother of mariachis, quite proud.
How more beautiful can you get when students coming to me would say, you know what, Mrs. O? My grandmother came in when I was playing and I was singing, and she says, where did you learn that song? And I said, at school.
For the world, I'm Jason Margolis, San Antonio.
Now, the Yucatan Peninsula is a bit different from the rest of Mexico. For example, while soccer is like a religion for most Mexicans, for many in the Yucatan's Mayan community, baseball's the sport of choice. And some Mexican Mayas have brought that passion with them to California. There's even a mostly Maya baseball league there. And if you head to one of their games, you'll hear not just Spanish, but the Maya language as well. The World's Monica Campbell has a story in collaboration with New America Media.
Here's a story about baseball and a healthy amount of ethnic pride. It's still preseason at a small ballpark in San Francisco, but it's a clear, warm Sunday, so friends and family are showing up. Typical American scene until you listen a bit closer. That's Lucy Gongora. She's talking about the tamales she sells here in her native Maya language. Most everyone here speaks it, except me. So she switches to Spanish to help me out. She says nearly everyone here is from the Mexican state of Yucatan, many from the same towns. It's a heavily indigenous place. Gongora left her daughters behind to work here. She was smuggled over the Arizona border in the trunk of a car. So the Sunday games take her home a bit. Same goes for the players.
Un domingo sin baseball no es un domingo.
It's not a Sunday without baseball, says one of this team's strongest players, Alberto Gomez.
En nuestros clubs, de donde somos nosotros, este Juan José Pacho.
Back home, Gomez went pro for a time, and he remembers facing some heavy hitters. But Gomez is 42 now and happy to be part of Club Yucatan. There are about a dozen Yucatec Maya teams like this in California, and growing as more Maya immigrants arrive. When I asked Gomez how to say baseball in Maya, one of his teammates, Gregorio Centina, chimes in.
Bacha bola.
Bacha bola? Me encanta.
Centina and Gomez speak Maya together. It keeps them connected to home. Gomez came to San Francisco for work more than a decade ago. He's a busboy in an Italian restaurant.
Carlos, Jorge, Jose, Jairo, Alberto.
So nearly everyone on the team is from the Yucatan. But the camaraderie, and maybe the food, draws in a few non-Mayans, including Levi Austin Sheets.
Levi Austin Sheets? I'm from Albany, California.
He's a bartender who used to play baseball. One of his co-workers, who's a player here, invited him to try out. It's Austin's first day.
It seems like a loving group of family. I love it. We've got tamales in the stands. Maybe I'll earn a couple of those today.
The players call him El Güero. It's Mexican slang.
You know, a white guy who speaks Spanish. I'm one above a gringo.
He's also like others here, working long hours in catering or in restaurants. The team's manager, Gaspar Chi, says his players usually show up bleary-eyed.
Por el trabajo. Muchas veces por doble trabajo que tienen.
It's a six-day work week, he says. Double shifts ending at 3 a.m. There's dedication, but also caution. Chi tells his players it's not worth getting injured just to win a game. The money you send home is too important. And it's a community that sticks together. In Mexico, prejudice against the Mayan population can run deep because of their darker skin, different languages. Alberto Perez runs a San Francisco nonprofit that serves the Maya community.
People picked on us because they can hear our accents. They can, you know, see that we are a little
shorter than they are, they can see that we look a little different.
Perez's parents are Maya from the Yucatan, but he grew up in Mexico City and hid his indigenous roots. He says in California, he feels freer.
I think in here, it's more okay to say, I'm Mayan, I'm indígena. I think people feel more comfortable coming out as indigenous as compared to Mexico. It's interesting because we have to come all the way here in this country that it's not perfect, but at least in terms of being able to identify ourselves as indigenous has been a little bit easier.
Todos vengan, everybody.
Back at the field, manager Gaspar Chi looks at his roster. A few good players haven't shown up for spring training. He says that a bunch of players went home to visit their families about a year ago for Christmas, but they haven't come back. Chi says it's harder to cross the border these days. He's waiting to see if his players turn up later this spring. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, San Francisco.
Now to New York City, home not just to a massive fleet of iconic yellow taxis, but to an amazing diversity of cab drivers. Roughly half of the city's 40,000-odd cabbies are Muslims who hail from countries all over the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere. And a great number of the drivers are observant, required to pray five times a day, which raises the question, how and where do these men on the move perform their prayers? Hillary Brenhouse reports.
When you spend your days driving a taxi cab, it's impossible to say where, at any given moment, you might wind up. Followers of Islam can perform their five daily prayers in any relatively clean space, even bow down on the side of the road. But the process isn't so simple. You first need to ritually wash with water, and then to prostrate yourself facing east, towards Mecca.
That's why we have an app in our iPhone. Right now I'm here, right? What I'm doing, I take my iPhone straight to Mecca. Technology.
I found Yusuf Kamal praying alone at the BP gas station on the corner of Houston and Lafayette Streets. He had taken a prayer mat from the cardboard box kept there for drivers, laid it down in front of the pumps, and was kneeling in the cold.
The prayer started like at 1 o'clock. Now it's 1:15. I've been looking for the parking since 12:40.
Parking is the chief anxiety of every observant driver in New York. There are five daily windows for worship, some briefer than others. The prayer itself takes but 10 or 15 minutes to complete, but it must be done on time. Otherwise, it expires.
We have to pray no matter what. Even you don't park, even you put in the bus stop, we have to go to pray.
New York's Muslim cab drivers have memorized a citywide circuit of mosques and other, more makeshift prayer spaces. Basements in South Asian restaurants, back rooms in gas stations and auto repair shops, certain parking lots. This way, the driver is prepared, no matter where his next destination.
Delancey and Eldridge. There's a restaurant and they have a basement just for a prayer. It's open 24 hours. Yeah.
Sometimes some people are praying in a gas station. Like here, 2nd Avenue, 1st Street, 36 and 10th Avenue.
We have a little mosque in JFK, in the parking lot, taxi lot. Sometimes they have a bag. You can open the bag to be a carpet, a prayer carpet.
At least, you know, the place is clean. We can pray anywhere.
Can I put the mirror on?
Yahia Nassar is headed to Midtown because, well, I'm his fare, and that's where I'm headed.
The next prayer is the sunset. It's 10 minutes to 5.
So Yahia has less than an hour, and he doesn't like to scramble.
To park illegal parking is not worth it. It's not worth it. Because if you go to pray and you get a ticket for 115 now, you can't make it the whole day.
Once passengerless, Yahia will switch the light on the roof of his cab off.
If you are not off and somebody stop you, you can't say no. So you have to be off duty to control your time and to find a place to park. Then you go to pray in peace.
Yahia drops me at the Midtown mobile station at sundown. Outside, customers are pumping gas. It's almost impossible to tell that inside, dozens of taxi drivers are bent on their knees in prayer. The men typically worship in a small, cramped room at the back of the service area,
But sometimes, like now, when there are no cars to be repaired, they spread their rugs over the entire garage. The minutes before prayer time are frantic. But as Yusuf Kamal says, in prayer, all of this seems to die away, and all that's left are the demands of faith.
One day happened to me, I missed the prayer. My mind, the whole day, it wasn't properly. There's like a time between you and God. It's like a meeting. If you have a meeting with your boss, if they tell you come at 8:30 p.m. or a.m., you feel crazy. You take a taxi, you take a subway, you run just to see the boss. Same thing.
For The World, I'm Hilary Brenhouse in New York.
Let's end the show today with some Persian comfort food. Asha Reshta is a thick winter soup that you can buy on the street in Iran. In New York, you can get it at Taste of Persia, NYC. It's not really a full restaurant, more like the corner of a pizza joint in Manhattan. As part of our ongoing look at the global tastemakers in the New York area, here's Saeed Purke, who thinks of his Asha Reshta as a lot more than just soup.
I started with Asha Reshta, and I didn't know that Asha Reshta can change my life. Good morning. How are you? I started around 3 o'clock in the morning, and right now is 7:20, and it's almost 5 hours, another hour or two to go, and it takes usually 7 to 8 hours from beginning to end. Can you give me those beans that we cook? Yeah. Garbanzo, red kidney, and black beans.
White beans, too.
And chickpeas, yeah. Give it to me. Yeah. I came to this country 1 year before the revolution in 1978. And that was my dream to come to the United States. I finished my school and army. I came here and... I went to the college, and I knew that I had to start working to make money. I'm going to add this spinach. After spinach, I put my fresh parsley. I used to work in a different printing house in Iran.
My cilantro.
I started doing the same thing here, and I built up a company with my three brothers. Deal? And a little bit of parsley flakes. And I use a little bit of tarragon. A few years ago, I decided to change profession because I wasn't too happy for what I do. And in life, everyone is good for one thing. And you can do in your life only one thing that you can be the best. And I think I could do something better.
Somehow, what is better than cinnamon?
And another thing, I use a lot of turmeric. After working for yourself for so many years, you cannot become an employee again. I refused to work, and somehow I ate my investment. I ate all the savings I had. I end up leaving my wife. When I separated, I have no place and I have no money. I got a little bit depression. And it was very, very difficult for me to find out what my passion is. At the age of 55, what else can I do that I don't make a mistake again? And I remember I always loved to cook, and I always cooked for my mom, cooked for my family. I remember this soup from my childhood, from the street of Tehran, when I had a little bit of money, running to the market and have this soup. And I wanted to bring it to New York. That was the first thing I started to present. It was Asha Reshta. What I do, I saute mint. This linguine has to be cut in 3 to 4 pieces. And I fried the onion to the point that is turning almost golden. That's the time I add the...
You have to add a little bit of salt and pepper?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of salt and pepper.
And this one, yeah, definitely tastes good. Mm.
Yep,
it's ready. That was my first idea to start with this complex soup because I believed in it.
Saeed Porkay of Taste of Persia, NYC. He told his story to the world's Alex Galifant. And you can see some pictures of Porkay in action and get a recipe for Asher Reshte at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. Now to another immigrant community, this one in Maine. The state's become home to a small but growing population of South Asians. Maine Public Radio's Patty White brings us a story of how one Hindu community is establishing its ethnic and religious roots there.
Except from the sign outside, you wouldn't likely suspect that the old Universalist church in a suburb of Portland, Maine, is now a Hindu temple. It's still got that classic New England church look with its white wooden clapboards. But step inside and see a space recently transformed by colorful streamers and garlands, portraits of Hindu gods, and music. It's the last day of a week-long celebration honoring Lord Ganesha, a Hindu deity. And Devin Bhatt, the president of the temple, says it's a fitting festival for the community.
Lord Ganesha is considered the remover of obstacles, and God knows we have had so many obstacles in our way.
It's because Maine's Hindu population isn't that big. There are only estimates of its size, from several hundred families to a couple thousand Hindus. But it's growing, and now Bhatt says the community's finally managed to establish its first public temple.
If you are in a bigger city, there is power in numbers. Here, because of the small community, the affordability, like how do you buy and do that?
It used to be that Hindus here would drive hours out of state to go to temple, or they'd hold celebrations in their homes. It was clear that a communal space in Maine was needed. So last December, when members spotted the old vacant Universalist church, they snapped it up. Bhatt says the place felt right.
I think the first feeling that comes to my heart, I feel it's very peaceful, the vibrations that I believe of the place that has been place of worship for 100 plus years.
To buy the church, the community needed to raise an extra $40,000. They collected that cash in just 10 days. Now, volunteers oversee the temple. On a recent afternoon, I met with Nagina Sawant. She rolls out mats in front of an altar for Lord Ganesha. Though she's a busy mom and doesn't drive, she finds rides or takes a bus to temple to clean and prepare for festivals.
We wanted a place to worship. We wanted a place where our children can all come together. Worship, socialize, culture, enhance their knowledge, you know, because otherwise we had to go all the way to Massachusetts to visit gods and to pray and to worship and to enjoy festivals.
So now Maine offers a space to worship on top of what already draws many Hindus to the state, good jobs and quality of life. Krishan Verma came to Maine 25 years ago for college, became a psychiatrist and never left. He and his wife Rashmi remember when they only had a few Hindu friends here.
Community was very small, and they used to have a group get together at their place in Harrison, I believe.
25 people, hardly.
Right, hardly.
Yeah, now we have a big, huge community, yeah. I would say, comparison to what we used to have.
Temple President Devin Bhatt came to Maine for an IT job, like many other Indians after the tech boom. Though he's only been in Maine for a couple years, he's lived in the U.S. for almost 30. He says that being part of the smaller, tight-knit Hindu community here has actually allowed him to rediscover his cultural identity.
I have done more kirtans and chanting here in 3.5 years than I ever did in my entire life.
Bhatt says he hopes the new Maine Hindu Temple, as it's called, will foster further growth in the local Hindu community. They've already opened their doors to other faiths and curious passersby.
We had a few people who walk in like, hey, I just saw the sign and I didn't know that this place existed here and I know about this and I practice this and can I come? And it just gives me so much joy.
Bhatt tells me that he once feared losing his Hindu culture in the U.S., now he says he's not afraid of that anymore. For The World, I'm Patty White in Portland, Maine.
Our next story is about a game of cat and mouse that plays out every night along the banks of the Rio Grande. On one side, the U.S. Border Patrol. On the other, migrants who cross the river into the U.S. illegally. Over the past 2 years, the number of migrants crossing at this part of the border has doubled, and so have migrant deaths. Monica Ortiz Uribe, with the public radio collaboration Fronteras, reports on the challenges of patrolling the South Texas border.
Night falls in the Rio Grande Valley outside Mission, Texas. The river glistens under a full moon, deceivingly peaceful. Suddenly, through a pair of night vision goggles, a Border Patrol agent spots movement. He picks up his radio.
Hey, 402, can you tell us on the raft?
A mother and her two infant boys are floating across on a raft. They'll make it onto U.S. soil, but their taste of success is brief. They're apprehended and put in the back seat of a Border Patrol Suburban. The family is from Guatemala, on their way to reunite with the woman's husband in the States. Now their fate will be a detention center and likely deportation. While apprehensions across the southern border are declining, South Texas is the one spot where the numbers are rising again. So far this year, the Border Patrol has detained nearly 200,000 people in this part of Texas. Mark Foster is a Border Patrol supervisor.
We could apprehend anywhere between 100 and 200 a shift.
In response, the Border Patrol is shifting resources and 600 more agents to South Texas. But the terrain out here doesn't help. The Rio Grande River swerves and curls downstream like a string of yarn. Access is limited by gravel pits, cliffs, and delicate wildlife refuges. There's also private homes and farmland where locals can make a pretty profit cooperating with smugglers. Daniel Perez is a newly minted Border Patrol agent.
It's down here, you got the river, and then they come into this jungle gym of a brush we got, and hiding spaces everywhere.
Historically, heavier enforcement has pushed immigrants out of urban centers to the deadly Arizona desert, and now rural Texas, which has its own dangers. Metal poles clank onto the back of Eric Canales' pickup. He's 70 miles north of the border in Brooks County, Texas. These poles will be topped with a giant blue flag.
Blue means water.
Canales works with a network of human rights groups. The blue flag is for a water station he's fixing to put in a nearby ranch that's frequently traversed by immigrants. 3 years ago, Brooks County recovered the bodies of 20 dead immigrants. Last year, the number of dead shot up to 129.
We save lives out here every week.
Lavosher Durham manages 1,300 acres on El Tule Ranch, west of the county seat of Falfurrias. It's rough country out here. Oppressive heat, thorny thickets, insects, and snakes.
You know, people have given up, and they're crawling to my house and knocking on my door, and please give me water, and please give me food.
The immigrants come through Durham's land to avoid the Border Patrol checkpoint south of town on U.S. Highway 281. In the last two decades, Durham has found his share of bodies. A telltale sign, he says, is a circle of buzzards.
Actually, you're pretty lucky when you find a dead one because of the coyotes and the vultures and the javelinas. They eat them up.
The majority of immigrants crossing the border now are from Central American countries like Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. They say violence back home makes life impossible, so they flee.
My name is Benny Martinez. I'm the chief deputy for the county of Brooks.
Martinez says last year, Brooks County spent nearly $200,000 burying the unidentified remains of border crossers in the local cemetery. There are also smugglers who operate here, he says. Recently, sheriff deputies stopped a U-Haul trailer stuffed with 70 migrants.
They're on U.S. soil, and this is where we need to step up and start doing something more proactive to where we can avoid this death out here.
This year, the body count is already at 70. At this pace, Martinez believes Brooks County could end up with more dead than last year. For The World, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe, reporting from the South Texas border.
The immigration debate in Washington has gotten plenty of ink and broadcast time, and in Colorado, time on stage, too. A play about the struggles of undocumented youth just wrapped up a successful run in Denver. The play is based on a book by Helen Thorpe, the separated wife of Colorado's governor. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
The story, Just Like Us, is about four young women from Mexico.
They were all brought to Colorado as young children by their parents, illegally. As they grow up, their fortunes start to change. Two of the teens get papers to remain in the U.S. legally. Two don't. The play begins with all four teenagers getting ready for prom. An older Latina woman is doing their hair.
You going to El College?
Trying. Is that why there's a white lady sitting in the corner taking notes?
Oh, hello. That's Helen.
Helen Thorpe.
Helen is a reporter, a very respected journalist.
She's writing a book about us.
I wanted to give people an opportunity who had no firsthand experience of this to really walk miles and miles in the shoes of these young people.
That's the real-life journalist Helen Thorpe, who wrote the book Just Like Us. She followed the young Mexican women for 5 years.
I found that the debate over immigration law was so incredibly superficial. Generally, people didn't even understand the laws that they were debating. So I wanted to engage readers to capture their attention by how dynamic and vibrant and charismatic these young people were, and then slip a lot of immigration law along. I wanted the reader to care about them as human beings and then understand the immigration predicament that they caught themselves in. And then I wanted the reader to make up his or her own mind about what they think the law should be.
Right. And how did this become a play? I mean, whose idea was it?
Yeah, no, it wasn't my idea. I actually was really surprised when I got an email from Kent Thompson at the Denver Center for the Performing Arts, and he wanted to commission a playwright to write a play based on my book. And he had the idea to get Karen Zacharias involved.
I am a Mexican immigrant myself, and I am a straight-A student like these girls. And this was a story that I do not see on stage, the story of the good girls, the story of the hardworking families, the story of not the gangs and the barrio and all of that, but the story of millions and millions of people who are in this country just working and trying to get through every day.
In the story, the two undocumented teens can't qualify for scholarships or in-state tuition. They watch as their childhood friends, those with papers, go off to college. But then their luck turns. Benefactors emerge, including a prominent Republican backer, to pay for the women to go to the University of Denver. In college, the women hide their legal status. It's a tense time in Colorado when former Republican Congressman Tom Tancredo leads the call to tighten immigration controls. His speeches on that are in the play. It's also a time when a Denver cop is killed by an undocumented Mexican immigrant. Overall, though, the play is a sympathetic portrayal of the young women, and by extension, undocumented immigrants. Playwright Karen Zacharias says she felt a visceral connection to the women. When I saw it, the 700-seat theater was sold out, and many in the audience, a racially diverse crowd, were crying.
People are moved because theater humanizes an issue. And seeing those four young ladies on stage night after night, you can't help but think, oh, this is not just politics. There's people.
The play has its share of critics, though, and Mexican actress Junwen Pardo knows that. She plays one of the women without papers.
Her name is Maricela, and she's a firecracker.
Maricela is brash and outspoken and dreams of going to law school. But after college graduation, she puts that dream on hold while she raises a child. In the play, the character of Helen Thorpe, the journalist, seems disappointed in Maricela's choices. Pardo describes how this scene played out one night in the theater.
There's a moment where I say, so you think that excelling at school is American and being pregnant is Mexican? And this guy said, well, that's the truth. But he screamed it from the audience. That day I was so fired up because it was just like it was right there.
Of course, Maricela isn't a fictional character. The real Maricela has seen the play 5 times. We met outside the theater, and I asked her how she deals with people like this heckler.
That's a very hard question. Sometimes I feel like those people, it's not even worth spending our time on. I don't think that you can really change people's minds who are that hateful.
I also met the real-life Yadira, the other undocumented woman depicted in the play. Yadira's mom brought her to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 3. She's now 27. I asked her why her family should get a pass to stay in the U.S. when they came here illegally.
Our parents and many parents come into this country to give their children a better life. We came to this country because it was a matter of survival.
In one particularly moving scene, Yadira's mom, a single working mother of 3, is caught using a phony ID. Rather than risk time in a detention center and then likely deportation, Yadira's mom tearfully says goodbye to her family and boards a bus for Mexico.
In the play, it shows her leaving pregnant. So I've never met my little sister. So it would be life-changing for me to be able to meet my little sister and see my mom again.
When was the last time you saw your mom?
Since she left in 2005. Yeah.
Stories like this of family separations and deportations have skyrocketed during President Obama's administration. But Yadira got some good news last week. She qualified for President Obama's program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It basically blocks the deportation of young people like her who are in good standing. But Yadira still lacks certain rights. For example, she can't travel legally to visit her mom in Mexico. The real-life Maricela got tired of living this way. Her husband is a U.S. citizen, but that doesn't give her an automatic right to become one, too. Because she was living here illegally, Maricela first had to leave the country, come clean, then apply to return. There's no guarantees, though. For some couples, the wait to come back can be 10 years or longer.
So we ended up taking the risk, and I did leave. It was almost a year of waiting in Mexico. My husband lost his job. My son went back and forth. It was a very traumatizing experience, but they approved it, and I'm back.
Maricela now does multicultural outreach work at public schools in Denver and has a 2-year provisional visa. I asked her if she's now sleeping better at night.
Oh, yes. It's changed my life in so many ways. But at times, though, I feel like some sort of guilt and privilege because so many of my friends and family members and millions don't have the same opportunity that I have.
The play Just Like Us has finished its 1-month run in Denver. The people invested in it told me they hope another city picks it up. They said it'd be nice if it ran in Washington and that some members of Congress would plan a night out at the theater. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Denver.
It's showtime for immigration reform. Tomorrow morning, legislation to overhaul the nation's immigration system will face its first big legislative hurdle, the Senate Judiciary Committee. The bill is not a done deal, and it's hard to predict what will happen as it navigates through both the Senate and the House. But if it passes eventually, it could radically change life for the 11 million immigrants currently living in the U.S. illegally. They could find themselves on a new path to citizenship, and a new legal status could make it possible for them to travel openly. For years, immigrants who are here illegally have been afraid to visit relatives back home for fear of not being able to come back. As part of our Global Nation coverage of immigration, Jude Joffe Block reports from Mexico on families hoping for long-awaited reunions.
It's a typical Sunday in the town of Tepeapulco in Mexico's central highlands. Families gather, cook, and catch up. And that's the scene at Santiago Dominguez's home. At 82 years old, he's the family patriarch. He's wearing pressed slacks, his dark hair smoothed back. By lunchtime, he's surrounded by relatives. But one person's always missing. Rosa, Dominguez's daughter. In the living room, there's a picture of her as a young woman. Dominguez says he thought she'd only be gone 3 or 4 years and then come back. But it's been 18 years since Rosa left for Arizona with her 2 young sons. They went illegally to join the boy's father there. She's now 43 and has never returned to Mexico. Without papers, it's just too risky. It got to the point, Dominguez says, that he started to say to his daughter, you know, I'm not sure if we'll see each other again. But now they might. A proposed Senate bill would allow millions of immigrants who entered the U.S. illegally to apply for provisional status and the chance to work legally and travel internationally. There's hope, like never before, Dominguez says, and it's a feeling felt throughout Mexico. A few towns over, Catalina Cervera knocks on a neighbor's gate to visit the house next door, the one her younger sister, Sandra, abandoned.
Buenos dias.
Cervera's sister left Mexico with her young children about 10 years ago. They crossed into Arizona illegally, picked produce, and now live near Phoenix. Cervera says that since her sister's been gone, thieves have stripped her house clean, even the roof. It's a cinder block skeleton. Cervera says she and her sister have felt impotencia, powerlessness. They want to see each other, but can't. Her sister couldn't visit when their mother was dying. And a few years ago, Cervera couldn't get a tourist visa to see her sister in Arizona.
Que tuviéramos cuenta en el banco, que si tuviéramos algún negocio, que si teníamos tarjetas de crédito. Entonces, desgraciadamente, pues no, no teníamos nada de eso.
Cervera says she lacked what's needed for a U.S. visa. Things like a bank account, a business, or a credit card. But now she can envision her sister and her sister's kids visiting Mexico again.
Están como motivados, ¿no? Con esa ilusión de que les va a llegar esa reforma migratoria.
Cervera says that they're encouraged, hopeful that immigration reform will happen. But as Congress debates the legislation, the wait continues.
Sin ti no podré vivir jamás.
Back in Tepeapulco, Dominguez's tradition is to sing to his daughter a famous Mexican ballad over the phone. It's called Sin Ti, or Without You.
Sin ti, ¿qué me puede ya importar? Si lo que me hace llorar es estar lejos de ti.
What else matters, he sings, if being far from you makes me cry. Over 1,000 miles away in Arizona, his daughter Rosa has become an activist for immigration reform. She's asked us to only use her first name because of her unauthorized status.
Quisiera que esto se hiciera ya, porque la vida de nuestros padres...
Rosa says immigrants like her need reform to happen now because their parents' lives won't wait. And if that does happen, if she can travel to Mexico freely, she says she'll surprise her dad with a mariachi band, and they'll play that ballad he's sung to her for the last 18 years.
Sin ti es inútil vivir.
For the world, I'm Jude Joffe Block in Hidalgo, Mexico.
El quererte olvidar.
Jude's report comes to us from the public radio collaboration Fronteras. Daniel, I think the story we're about to hear about Felipe Montes and his kids, I mean, it shows just how nuanced all these immigrant experiences really are. They're shaded and not black and white.
Yeah, absolutely. It's complex. It's frustrating. It's a troubling story. It's a uniquely American story, I think, about families and borders and politics and geography. Journalist Seth Fried Wessler worked on this piece with Radio Ambulante producer Nancy Lopez, and here it is.
Felipe Montes's story begins in October of 2010 in Sparta, a mountain town in North Carolina. After breakfast with his wife, Marie, and their young kids, he walked to the courthouse for a routine parole meeting. He'd racked up too many traffic violations. But this time, immigration officers were waiting for Montes. After almost a decade of living in the United States without papers, he was deported to Mexico, away from his family. In Mexico, Montes worked nonstop, anything to not miss his family.
I get up in the morning, 6 in the morning every day, no matter if it's Saturday or Sunday. 6 in the morning, get ready by 7, start walking.
Then it got worse. Montes's wife, Marie, had debilitating health issues. She struggled without Montes, the kid's main caretaker and family breadwinner. And soon after he was sent to Mexico, officials from social services put the couple's three young U.S.-born sons, Isaiah, Adrian, and Angel, into foster care. But Montes said he could care for his kids. From Mexico, his wife agreed too. For the next 2 years, Montes would fight to reclaim his children. He isn't alone. The U.S. deported at least 180,000 parents of U.S. citizen children in the past 2 years, based on government data requested by the news site colorlines.com. It left thousands of children in foster care. Donna Shoemate is Montes' attorney. She realized there weren't clear policies for reuniting families split by deportation.
I asked the question of the social worker on the witness stand a few times. If the Department of Social Services had a policy with dealing with parents who were not U.S. citizens, who were actually located outside of the country, whether it be Mexico, France, Canada, wherever. And each time I asked the question, the answer was, no, we do not have a policy.
Social services argued Felipe and Marie's kids should stay in foster care. Those officials and the foster families involved declined interviews for this story. As for Montes, the outlook appeared grim. He was in Mexico and couldn't defend himself in person. Last August, U.S. officials allowed Montes to return temporarily to North Carolina to fight for his kids. But his return wasn't easy. His 5-year-old son, Isaiah, was confused. He asked Montes, "Are you going to adopt me?"
I said, "I don't come to adopt you. I'm your father. I come for you because I love you."
In court, Montes argued he'd always cared for his kids. "I'm their father," he said. Montes won. Here's Shoemate, Montes' attorney again.
And the judge found that Felipe was not unfit and that he had not acted inconsistently with his constitutional status as a parent. And it's not a test over whether children are better off in the United States or in Mexico. It doesn't make him unfit that he was undocumented here. It doesn't make him unfit that he was deported.
In March, Montes and his sons boarded a plane to Mexico. Because of her health, Marie didn't follow.
See that? I am the great.
See this?
Great.
See this?
I met Montes and his boys in the Mexican state of Michoacán. They lived with Montes' mother and siblings in a tiny house. The kids seemed happy, playing in the streets with neighbors. But they were also in a country they'd never known.
Everything for them is new. It's totally different than what it used to be. A lot of difference. Over there in America, the jobs, it's a lot of grass.
In contrast, Montes said, Mexico looks bland, dry fields. But one person was thrilled. Montes' mother, Griselda.
Pero es hermoso porque pues no me esperaba ver unos niños tan preciosos. No.
She hadn't seen her son for years. He was still handsome, she said. And she'd also never met her 3 grandchildren. She called them precious. Montes also tried to ease the transition. The first day he left the house to look for work, he left a list of English translations for his mom. After a week, though, the boys were already understanding their grandmother's Spanish. But the children worried about abandonment every time their father walked out the door.
He asked me if I could leave him again. I said, "I never left you. You just got deported last time." I tried to explain to him for him to understand.
Truth is, Montes is struggling in Mexico. Home is in North Carolina with his wife, and he's got a landscaping job there. In Mexico, he found some work loading scrap metal onto trucks, but it barely pays, and it's why Montes headed to the U.S. in the first place. Montes hopes he'll be allowed to move back to the U.S. with his kids.
I can come back to America, be with my wife and my kids, start a new life, like a family, like it used to be.
But for that to happen, he's betting on the immigration reform bill being debated by senators now. In it, there's a provision that would let deportees with kids and spouses in the U.S. apply to return. For The World, I'm Seth Fried Wessler, Mexico.
To see a slideshow of the Montes family and their journeys, go to theworld.org. We've also included a selection of other stories in Spanish and English from our partners at Radio Ambulante.